I want to welcome you to the 433rd meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, both to our members and guests who are here with us today, and to our radio audience, reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting comes to you from the Elks Event Center in Rockland, Maine, and I'm George Look, president of the Forum. The Forum was founded in 1983 as a citizens' forum for study and discussion of the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies and the factors influencing them. We are now in our 37th year of forum meetings to hear an invited expert talk about issues critical to the formulation of U.S. foreign policy and to answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about and audios of past forum talks, upcoming forum programs, and how to become a forum member are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. Today we are very pleased to have with us Dr. Deborah Bronk, who will be speaking on the health of the world's oceans. Dr. Deborah Bronk is the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Bigelow Laboratory for Ocean Sciences in East Boothbay, Maine. Her research centers primarily on the health of aquatic systems and especially the role of nitrogen. Prior to joining the Bigelow Laboratory 2 years ago, Dr. Bronk was a professor and researcher at the College of William and Mary in Virginia. Dr. Bronk's work ranges from pioneering basic research into how marine organisms take up and produce nitrogen to applied questions about the composition and removal of nitrogen in wastewater treatment plants, quite a variety of interests. She has led or participated in over 50 research expeditions from the Arctic to the Antarctica. In 2008, Dr. Bronk was elected president of the Association for the Sciences Association for the Sciences of Limnology and Oceanography, the largest international society devoted to the aquatic sciences. From 2012 to 2015, she served at the National Science Foundation, including as director of the Division of Ocean Sciences. As division director, Dr. Bronk oversaw a budget of over $350 million and was responsible for funding core scientific programs and ocean research facilities. In that position, she also co-chaired the Subcommittee on Ocean and Science Technology, which includes representatives from the 24 federal agencies with links to ocean science. In 2018, she served as the chair of the Council of Scientific Society Presidents, an organization that represents over a million scientists across a broad range of disciplines in the United States. Dr. Bronk is the recipient of numerous scientific and academic awards. These include the prestigious Lindemann Award, given annually by the Association for the Sciences of Limnology and Oceanography, the Antarctic Service Medal from the U.S. Armed Forces for her services in Antarctica, the Dean's Prize for the Advancement of Women in Science from the Virginia Institute of Marine Sciences, and the Plumeri Award for Faculty Excellence from William and Mary. In 2015, she was named a Sustaining Fellow of the Association for the Sciences of Limnology and Oceanography, and in 2016, the Virginia Institute of Marine Sciences named her the Moses D. Nunley Distinguished Professor of Marine Science. In 2018, she received the Virginia Outstanding Faculty Award, the Commonwealth's highest honor for faculty at Virginia's public and private universities. We are very glad that Deborah decided to move to Maine, and I welcome her to the Midcoast Forum.
Okay, thank you very much. Can you, everybody hear me? Yep. Not quite. Yes? Can everybody hear me? Good. Is that move up or thumbs up? Thumbs up. Okay. So what an honor to be asked to talk to you today. Thank you so much. This is an amazing group, which I learned a lot last night at a reception that I got to attend. Today I'm going to talk to you about the health of the ocean. And I'm going to start off with a bit of honesty here, and I'm going to say it is not great. I actually thought I would get a little bit of a laugh with that, but that I guess that's not really that funny, but it's not great. The ocean is facing just incredible challenges on many fronts, most of which have some impact on humanity and all the things that we need the ocean to provide for our quality of life and the safety of our environment. If I had to pick the top three, I would say pollution, overfishing, and climate change. To give you kind of a snapshot of pollution, and the proxy here is clean water, I'm going to show a couple of slides from an Ocean Health Index, which is an effort. You can look them up online. It's a very interesting website where they're trying to pull together lots of different variables and on a number of different topics to give a the goal of a given topic and then how they are making an assessment of how we're doing in terms of that. Their clean water index includes things like pollution, trash, chemical toxins, excess nutrients. And if you look at a map of the world, you can see that within the economic exclusive economic zones, which are the 200 nautical miles that go out from the coast along all the various countries, these are the waters that the adjacent country has sovereignty over. The blue colors show that the waters are doing relatively well. And as you get to the warmer colors, the waters are not doing as well. When you get to red, they're severely degraded. And most of the coastlines of the world are not doing that great, and in some cases severely degraded. If you do something like moving on to fisheries, wild-caught fisheries, so these are natural stocks of fisheries, not aquaculture, out in the oceans that various that are being harvested. And we see a similar thing with the index there. Not very many blue, cool tones in the coastal waters of the world. Most of them are these warmer tones showing a degradation, in some places, severe degradation. This is important because over half of the world's population derives some form of protein from the ocean. And a full billion people on the planet, it's their main source of protein. So when you are degrading wild-caught fisheries, you are really talking about food security for a very large number of people. If we go out from the coastal zones into international waters, the situation is just as bad, especially if you look at areas in the North Pacific. I'm pointing to this very nicely on my own screen, which I can see is not going to do any good here. If you look in the North Pacific, the South Atlantic, parts of the Indian Ocean, severely degraded in terms of fisheries, not doing well at all. But the big ball of wax here in terms of the health of the ocean right now has to do with climate change. And most of the comments I'm going to give you today are related to climate change. And what I've organized these comments around on kind of general principles that hopefully will help you read with a more critical eye a lot of the information that is out in the world right now about the oceans and climate change in general. Many of these are what I based. This past year, I gave testimony before Congress a couple of times, and this is what I would love all of our elected representatives to understand about climate change. So Earth has a greenhouse effect. Mankind didn't cause it. This would be a cold, dead rock, and none of us would be sitting here if the Earth didn't have this greenhouse effect. Earth is surrounded by an atmosphere of gases, and those gases, as solar radiation comes in, are absorbed by the land, particles in the atmosphere. Some of it makes it back out, but some is retained, and that's what warms up our planet. The issue is that over the last 100 years, we have been pumping carbon dioxide, taking it deep in the ground as fossil fuels, burning it and releasing it into the atmosphere. Currently, it's around 37 billion tons of carbon every year. Now, we can talk about this as it's an evil thing and it's a bad thing, but it has powered the incredible society that we have today. You can have a baby today and realistically expect that that child will grow to be an elderly person. The demonization of fossil fuels, I think, is something we need to avoid because it really shuts down conversations with a lot of the people we need to be talking to. Nonetheless, it causes problems, a lot of problems, because as we're taking that carbon from the ground, putting it into the atmosphere, we are thickening that blanket. And in thickening that blanket, we are retaining more of the solar radiation that's coming in from the atmosphere, and the planet's warming. You hear a lot about controversy on climate change. There is no controversy with this. This is Svante Arrhenius. Anybody that took a chemistry class knows Arrhenius. In 1885, this gentleman gave a talk laying out the very basic principles of how if you increase atmospheric gases, you will warm the planet. There is no discussion about this process scientifically. What it leads to and how we deal with it is a lot of controversy, but the science behind a warming planet if we increase atmospheric carbon has been settled for a very, very long time. As we put carbon in the atmosphere, we are seeing this increase consistent through time. We see this, the most famous data set for carbon in the atmosphere is the Keeling curve. This was started back in the mid-50s. By two gentlemen, a father and son team, the Keelings. I actually met the junior Keeling at a meeting in the 90s, and he was a young man, and I was like, is this guy a vampire? Because he's been doing this for a really long time. But it's a father and son that have carried this curve on. These are being measured at the top of Mauna Loa in Hawaii, so which is about as good a place as any if you want an integrated measurement of concentrations in the atmosphere. And the increase and decrease you see of the sine wave is the planet breathing in carbon in the spring, and then as it is remineralized by microbes throughout the rest of the year in the northern hemisphere, the concentration of carbon goes back up. But it's going up continuously. The last global estimate for an average is 407.4 parts per million. At the start of the Industrial Revolution, it was 280 parts per million. So an enormous change. In the last 100 years or so. Now, this increase in carbon and atmospheric gases has two main results in the ocean. One is that it makes the ocean warmer, and the second that it makes the water more acidic. And both of these changes have implications, very far-reaching implications, for what's going on in the ocean and the health of the ocean. When it comes to ocean warming leads to the melting of sea ice. This is seen most prominently up in the Arctic. Right now, Ed Bigelow has a group of scientists involved in MOSAIC, which some of you might have seen in the news. It's the largest international science expedition to the Arctic in history, and it's ongoing right now with a number of ships, one of which is locked in an ice flow, which unfortunately keeps breaking. They've been having a very hard time at the very top of the world finding strong enough ice to lock the ship into. This is devastating for the local native populations, the Inuits and Inupiats in Alaska and all around the Arctic, because it impacts subsistence hunting. In coastal Alaska, subsistence hunting contributes around 600 calories per person in native villages. So it's a significant amount of their daily nutrition or annual nutrition. The other big thing is that it is causing massive coastal erosion. The situation is that the land used to be frozen. It was permafrost. And it was protected all along the coast by sea ice. Sea ice that extended very far from the coast. Well, now that ice is not on the coast for a longer period of time, and the land isn't frozen. So as the incoming waves, it is just churning up the coastline. So I've spent the last 15 years doing work in Ukiagvik, which was formerly known as Barrow, Alaska, the northernmost village in Alaska. And the change in that community in the last 15 years is just devastating. And at the rate of erosion, I don't even see how it's still here in even 10 years. Another problem with melting sea ice is that it affects albedo, which is the reflectance of a surface. Sea ice is very light-colored. And it reflects about 90% of the incoming solar radiation that strikes it. So all that energy is reflected back off. Whereas that dark open blue water, just like a dark asphalt parking lot, only reflects back about 10%, which means 90% of that energy is imparted to the water, the generating heat. And so the more energy retained, the warmer the water becomes, the more the ice is going to melt. So it's this kind of vicious feedback loop. Ocean warming leads to increases in sea level rise. I recently moved here from Virginia, where sea level is happening in real time. After every storm, there are more homes that are being abandoned or land that just people aren't using anymore. So I think Virginia is probably Maine in about 30 years But it was very real, very practical. I have an apartment building I need to sell down there to a climate denier quickly. If you know any, send them my name. But don't tell them why I'm calling them. Now, this increase in sea level is for two reasons. One is simple thermal expansion. If you heat up water, it will take up more space because its density is decreasing. And you can see this in your car if you leave a Coke in your car on a hot day. The Coke kind of bottle kind of burps out. The other thing is we are melting ice sheets and glaciers. So this is ice on land that as they're melting, the water is flowing in. It's different than the floating ice that I was talking about a moment ago in the Arctic. That is ice like in your glass. When your ice cube melts, it doesn't overflow. It's already in the water. Right now, since 1900, we're at about 7 to 8 inches average in sea level rise, but this is nothing compared to what will happen as we lose Greenland ice sheets, and they are on the move. Part of the problem is the warming seawater is degrading underneath them, and it's just skidding the bottom of these ice sheets and increasing their movement towards the ocean. Ocean warming also leads to the changes in distributions of organisms. So you've got a temperature range that is optimal for an organism, and as it warms, there's been this general migration of organisms towards the poles, northern in the northern hemisphere and southward in the southern hemisphere. The lobster is a classic example. There used to be a robust lobster fishery off of Cape Cod and off of Long Island. Well, so now the Long Island fishery is pretty much gone, and a lobsterman in Cape Cod are having to go farther and farther north to fish. This has benefited Maine a lot. The Maine lobster industry is booming. Some of it is because the fishermen in Maine have been excellent stewards of the fishery. But it's also because a lot of the lobsters are moving north. But we shouldn't kid ourselves that they're going to just stop here unless we do something. This is important because the location and movement of organisms in the ocean is what fisheries depend on. In the United States, it's about $200 billion of our gross national product is coming from the fishing sector, and it contributes about 1.6 million jobs. So a lot of people depend on knowing where organisms are going to be reliably, and right now, they're on the move. Another thing about ocean warming is that it increases stratification. So in a really simple way to think about the ocean is that it's got two layers. The surface layer, in contact with the atmosphere where the light is, has less dense water because it is warmed by the atmosphere. It is also receives rain, and so that fresh water makes it less salty. And those two things, the warmth and the lack of salt, makes it less dense. And so we've got a dense surface layer on the top of the ocean, and then the deeper depths are colder, more dense. And then you've got mixing as the wind blows across the surface of the ocean. That friction against the water is what causes all of the ocean currents in the world. And those ocean currents and the wind mixing will mix the water down to some certain depth. Now, if you warm the water, you are going to decrease that depth of mixing. You're going to increase that temperature, which is going to make it even less dense. And it's going to be harder to mix that water column. And because it's harder to mix that water column, things like nutrient delivery from the deep ocean is going to diminish, and it's going to make just a much more stable water column. One way to think about this is if you have salad dressing. You know, you really have to mix that oil and water together vigorously because the density is different. It doesn't want to mix. That's what's happening in the ocean. This also impacts oxygen. Some is that mixing of the atmosphere into the ocean is imparting oxygen. But it's also much more simple in that warm water can hold less oxygen than cold water. That's just basic chemistry. Oh, there's also a whole slew of biological processes that come into play with reducing oxygen, which is resulting in dead zones all around the world. The most famous in the U.S. is in the Gulf of Mexico. I just don't have time to go into those, but biology also plays a big role. So then there's ocean acidification. So with ocean acidification, if you increase carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere, it's going to reach equilibrium with dissolved carbon dioxide in the ocean. So if you increase it in the atmosphere, you're increasing it in the ocean. When carbon dioxide entered seawater, it combines with water to form carbonic acid. And it's that carbonic acid that is responsible for lowering the pH and making water a little more acidic. The other thing that's very insidious about this process is these inorganic carbon forms, carbonic acid, carbon dioxide, bicarbonate, and carbonate. The relative distribution of these different forms and how they exist in the ocean depends on pH. The more acidic it becomes, the lower the pH, the less carbonate is going to exist in the ocean. And carbonate is what forms with calcium to form calcium carbonate. And that is what organisms use to build their shell. That's what corals use to build coral reefs. Right now, it's harder and harder in acidic waters for these organisms to build their shells. And in some areas, coral reefs are actually degrading. They're dissolving because it's so acidic. One of the things I am most worried about personally as an oceanographer is this next point. Ocean acidification also affects the type of organisms, type of phytoplankton that can be in a given region. So Bigelow Laboratory for Ocean Science has been around for 45 years. We study the little guys. We are probably the best in the world at studying the base of the ocean food web in terms of the phytoplankton and the microbes. And there are thousands of different types of phytoplankton. Some of them, called coccolithophores, are the ones that have these plates. These plates are made out of calcium carbonate. They're called coccoliths. The things about coccolithophores is that they have a soft body inside, so they take up carbon like any other plant-like organism, but then they have a lot of carbon tied up in these plates. The other thing about them is that they're heavy, and so they tend to sink. Now, other forms of types of phytoplankton are flagellated forms. They have soft bodies, they're not as heavy, and they have flagella that they can't really swim, but they can do a little bit to maintain their distribution in the water column. The situation is if you combine ocean acidification and warming, it's kind of a double whammy in terms of the type of organisms that can be out there. The amount of phytoplankton may be exactly the same. The types are changing, though. So in the case of coccolithophores, they're heavy. They're only going to really be able to live in a water column where there's a lot of mixing that's keeping them mixed up towards the surface. Because if it gets too stratified, they're just going to sink. Now, that sinking is a good thing, because when they sink, they take all that carbon with them. Then you've got these more stratified areas. The organisms that exist in these areas tend to be the flagellated kind, soft bodies. They don't sink. And they have flagella that help them stay in the water column. So moving from a system where we had much more mixing of the water column to a much more stratified ocean, we are going to be selecting for these organisms that don't sink. And when we do that, we are reducing the ocean's ability to take up carbon. And there's evidence right now that that's happening, and this is probably one of the main mechanisms. As an oceanographer, this really terrifies me. Okay, so now what? So that's the bad part and the dour message of the talk. Do I think it's hopeless? Not at all. There is so much we can do. But you hear, I just read an article not too long ago, that who's going to deliver the silver bullet for climate change? There is not going to be a silver bullet. It's going to be tens of thousands of different discoveries, innovations, and changes that we're all going to make. All of those are going to have some role of science. In terms of the ocean, I think what we need is this kind of three-pronged approach. Adaptation, which is just learning to live differently, learning to take advantage of what's happening and modify our behavior to get around it. Mitigation is actually reducing the changes we see in the environment, or in some cases, reversing it. You know, if we could pull carbon out of the atmosphere, that would be a great thing. And then monitoring. Monitoring is the non-sexy side of science. It's going out and doing the same thing year after year, day after day, week after week. But it's the only way we are going to be able to tell if any changes we make are effective, whether they're working. And it's the only way we're going to really understand the situation we're dealing with. So I want to put a plug out there for monitoring. So to give you some examples of these, some concrete things that Bigelow is doing, just as an example of how I think we're going to work in the coming years, I'm going to show the work of three scientists, Nicole Price, Steve Archer, and Dave Emerson. The first one is going to be an example of how is adaptation and how we can learn to live and deal with some of these issues around acidification. So if you look at a map of the Gulf of Maine, I used to work in the Gulf of Mexico. It's taken me a long time, so the G-O-M is not Mexico. Gulf of Maine. pH has decreased throughout the bay, and it's especially low along the coast. This is a problem because it's along the coast is where we have our fisheries and where we're trying to develop aquaculture. Now, let me go back. If you were to put a adult lobster into acidified waters, probably not going to have much of a problem. You put mussels, grown mussels, into acidified water, again, it's not going to be that bad. The problem and where they are most vulnerable is when you get, is at the juvenile or larval stages. Baby mussels and baby lobsters that are really fighting against getting enough food to survive and not be eaten, if they have to expend a lot more energy because the shells and exoskeletons that they're growing are being eroded away by the surrounding water, it can be the difference between life or death, which has a big impact on the adults and the number of adults you're going to have in the future. So one of the great things that Maine has is it has kelp. Kelp is a, you can almost see it grow. It grows so fast. It's an amazing, amazing species or group. And it's also a carbon sponge. It grows so fast because it takes up carbon very rapidly. In taking up that carbon from the water, it's reducing carbonic acid. And in reducing carbonic acid, it's reducing the acidity. And that actually goes out around where the kelp is growing some distance. It's a halo of water that looks much more like it did in years past before ocean acidification was at play. So Nicole Price and Brittany Honish and her team at Bigelow did an experiment using a whole slew of interns as well. And they grew mussels within a kelp farm and outside of a kelp farm. The mussels grown outside of the kelp farm had thinner shells, which meant they had greater loss from predation and less meat. The mussels grown within the kelp farm had thicker shells, less predation, and more meat. So it was a much better product. So by combining kelp farming and mussel farming together, we can really get around ocean acidification for this one industry. In terms of mitigation or reducing climate change overall, one example that we're going after is methane. So I've said a lot about carbon dioxide, but methane concentrations are about 16% of the gases that we are putting out into the environment. Methane, though it's only 16%, packs a big wallop in that its warming potential, once it gets into the atmosphere, is about 84 times that of carbon dioxide. So going after methane is a way to really be going after a lot of warming potential. Now, it turns out one of the main man-made sources of methane are cows. Cows produce, an average cow produces about 265 pounds of methane. You don't think of gas having weight, but if you've worked in a lab and moved tanks around, you know that it does. So what we are trying to do is limit the amount of methane production from cows. Now, the reason why cows produce methane is as they eat their feed, they have microbes within their rumen that produce methane. About 95% of the methane that's produced comes out the front, despite all of the comics and the jokes. It's not coming out of the back. It's coming out of the front. And that's a really bad thing. It's a bad thing for the atmosphere. It's a bad thing for the farmer who's raising the cows because that is feed that isn't going into meat or milk. And it's uncomfortable for the cow as well to be producing all of this gas. Well, it turns out Australian scientists discovered that if you feed cows kelp, they don't burp as much methane. Now, one of the problems is there is not enough kelp in the world to really make a dent when it comes to production of methane by cows because there are so many cows. Now, there are some groups that are working on Asparagopsis, which is another type of seaweed as a way to reduce methane. But at Bigelow, we believe that the only scalable option is really to get the compounds that the kelp produce, which are bromophores, and produce them with single-celled organisms that you can raise anywhere. When it comes to phytoplankton, all you need is water and sunlight, so you can grow them in the middle of Oklahoma, which incidentally is where there are a lot of cows. So what we are working on is developing a feed supplement that we can so that we can give to cows to reduce methane production. And it's an incredibly exciting project. And man, if we can pull this off, I think it'll be the biggest thing that any of us have ever been involved in. And then the last thing is monitoring. So I said monitoring is the non-sexy side of science. Well, not always. We have a very sexy new project in monitoring a technology at Maine. This is Maine eDNA, environmental DNA. This is a partnership with the University of Maine and a number of other institutes across the state. The idea behind this is that you can take a glass of seawater collected from the environment, and you, by analyzing the DNA in that glass, you know all the organisms that passed through that water in the previous 24 to 48 hours. So we can isolate the DNA from all the single-cell organisms. If there's a right whale that passed through that water, they left behind DNA. We can know that. Lobsters, fish, anything. The challenge of this project, and what's really exciting about it, is as an oceanographer, you go out, you don't really know what's in the water, right? So imagine being a forest scientist and not knowing what trees you're looking at. We can't see what we're dealing with. In order to identify cells, you have to be highly trained. It takes a long time to sit at a microscope to count and determine what type of species are out there. With this, we can get snapshots, genetic fingerprints of the whole community very rapidly. Now, at Bigelow, we're really good at working with microbes. We can isolate the DNA and figure out who it is very quickly. The challenge of this project is going to be getting that information quickly into a form that people can use. So in our new strategic plan, we're launching a big data discovery initiative as part of this project, because who cares if we know what's out there if we can't get that information into the hands of fishermen or managers or somebody, for example, harvesting shellfish? They want to know if there are toxic algae in the water, right? They want to know when there's enough to cause a problem, not enough to hurt an industry and prevent farmers from, fishermen from feeding their families. So this kind of information is incredibly powerful and will really be important going forward. This grant is also an EPSCoR grant, and it's a program that is about capacity building within the state. So our hope is that we will be bringing, as we develop this technology, a lot of good, high-paying jobs to expand the Maine workforce through this work. Okay, so what I want to end with for this part, and I've got a few more slides to go, but I want to end with, science is really hope. We can do this. The United States of America is an incredible country, and as long as we support our science and engineers, there is no doubt in my mind that we will be able to solve the problem of climate change. And working with the international community is going to be critical, because we need everybody involved in this situation. But I am not pessimistic, I'm optimistic, and I think we can rise to the challenge. But because of the kind of talks that I've heard you guys listening to, I wanted to give you an idea of a few of the roadblocks that I see impacting science in this country. The three things are informed citizens, science funding, and the science workforce. So let's start with informed citizens. As I said, I testified before Congress. I did two testimonies this past year. The first one was before the House. I was honored to be on that panel with Carol Browner, the former head of the EPA. And my job was to present the science of climate change and how it was impacting the ocean. Now, all of my comments, and you actually got my written testimony is what I gave to be distributed if anybody was interested. I used consensus documents in order to prepare my testimony. So these are documents like the Fourth National Climate Assessment that the U.S. put out. These are documents that scientists have gone through rigorous peer review, have been developed through a very rigorous process of bringing information in, how to process that information with large groups of scientists, how it is reviewed, how they deal with comments and controversies. It is good as it gets in terms of science information. One of the things that I wish I had at the time was a recent report that came out by the IPCC the International Panel on Climate Change, which is the ocean and cryosphere in a changing ocean. It's available. These are all available freely online. If you want to direct somebody for the truth, like what's the status of our understanding in the science, go to these kind of documents. Well, that's what I was using. And these documents are especially important because, like this mug said, scientists argue, arguing with a scientist is like wrestling a pig in the mud. Sooner or later, you realize the pig likes it. We argue for, this is a tough crowd. I think it's really funny. Scientists argue for a living, right? We are trained to nitpick because that's how we get better. That's how we find the weaknesses in our experimental design, in how we're explaining something in a manuscript. So for scientists to get together, one, to even take the time to try to come to consensus means it's important. Because otherwise we wouldn't waste our time. Two, if we can come to any kind of consensus, it means there's data that is strong and robust, because otherwise we would just argue and not agree on anything. When it comes to climate change, there are these very powerful consensus documents. That's what I was using for my testimony. And yet, as you can see from the look on my face, as the gentleman to my left, this was a climate denier. And the problem with this picture, one, is I'm very dismayed. The woman behind him is even more dismayed, Sarah Cooley from the Ocean Conservancy, is that what I was saying and what he was saying was taken with the same weight on this panel. And this is what we have to fight against. This is what we have to fight against. So promoting the National Academy reports, these consensus documents put out by the government, the IPCC reports, these are what we should be turning to for information, and we should be very, very critical of what we read, even if it's from reputable sources. Question what you're reading and really go after correct information. We need an informed citizen, citizenship as we're moving forward. Then there's science funding. So as George mentioned, I was the director for the Division of Ocean Sciences. I managed a budget of $356 million. That's a huge amount of money. Until I realized all the stuff that I had to do with it. And until I also took a step back and said, for a country this size, that's about a dollar a person, okay? You probably spent four times that the last time you bought a cup of coffee. Well, maybe you didn't, but if you bought a latte, you did. I was just thinking my dad would never have spent that for a cup of coffee. But that's crazy. That is what this country right now is investing in, a fundamental understanding of our ocean. And that fundamental understanding is what agencies like NASA and NOAA and the National Institute of Health are building their work off of. It's not enough. It's not nearly enough. The other thing is the federal government is also not great at doing something called bridging the valley of death. Now, if a scientist has an idea, and I'm going to take the methane project as an example, there's a problem. Methane is being released by cows. We had a scientist, Steve Archer, that had an idea. Let's see if we can tackle this by studying the methane-producing microbes in the gut of the cow. Now, we know we need to get over here to a feed supplement. We need to get to that feed supplement that the cost of which is low enough that the increase in productivity of that cow in terms of meat or milk production will more than pay for it. Because if that doesn't happen, they're not going to buy it. So we need to bridge that gap in between. Now, in this particular project, we're going like gangbusters because we have a very savvy, very forward-thinking philanthropist. His name is Andrew Davis. Andrew Davis is part of the Andrew Davis Cullum Foundation, and he is supporting us in terms of intellectual property protection, helping us navigate the FDA approval process. But that's really hard money to get. And yet the federal government really doesn't support that. But we can have all the great ideas over here, and if we can't get it out into the market or in use, what's the point? We've got to, as a country, we've got to figure out how to bridge that gap and be more effective. Or we've got to find a lot more really wealthy people like Andrew Davis, who understands the situation and can help scientists. And then the last thing I want to say is about the ocean workforce, or the science workforce. Let me back up once. In the last 20 years, what I've seen in ocean science, and from my work through the Council of Scientific Society presidents, I know that ocean science is not unique, is that it is harder and harder and harder for our foreign science colleagues to come and stay in this country. One of the reasons the United States has been such a powerhouse in terms of science and technology is that we welcomed the best and the brightest of the entire world. They came here, they were trained, and many of them wanted to stay, and then we let them, and we welcomed them. And because of that, we captured all that passion and brilliance of those people. If you look at PhD-level scientists in the U.S. right now, it's a low from in terms of social science of what? Around 18%, to when it comes to computer and mathematical science, over 55% are foreign-born. Now, ideally, we would have an American a cohort of scientists that we are training up right now in elementary schools and high schools to go on and fill a lot of these jobs. But if we're going to do that, we've got to stop treating education and teaching as a second-class profession, and we've got to get serious about training the workforce that we need. But even if we did that, we would still want those foreign scientists, because when you come from a different country and a different culture, you look at things differently, and we want those different perspectives, because that's how you get the best science. A lot of different people who don't think the same, looking at the same problem, that's how you solve problems. And right now, what I'm seeing is it's harder and harder for them to stay in the country. And I am saying goodbye to too many brilliant young scientists that just cannot figure out a way through the visa system to stay in this country. And other countries are welcoming them with open arms. China is one of the most important that is bringing in a lot of foreign scientists. And we need to be paying attention to this, because if we want to stay the science leader in the world, and I want us to, because I believe in our system of government, we've got to reverse this trend. With that, I wanted to say thank you for your attention. I always try to end on something on what can you do for your own carbon footprint. You can go online and you can find dozens of slides and ideas of how you can reduce your carbon footprint. I've decided every time I give a talk, I'm going to give one specific thing: wash in cold water. All you do is you're going to have to change the knob to a different setting or push a different button. It is actually surprisingly impactful in your energy expenditure. It's less damaging for your clothes. Clothes are one of the big energy expenses when we manufacture clothes. Also incredibly polluting of the environment in most cases, and it'll save you money. The other thing is vote. One of the issues with voting is we need to know who to vote for. And in order to vote, to know who to vote for, we need scientists to be much more informed about science. They need to be able to answer questions about science. They need to have a plan on how they're going to address issues in your community related to climate change. Right now, there's so little talk about science by politicians. We also need more scientists to run for Congress. But I don't know if that was a bad way to end. So vote. So, thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Always useful to have both the problems, but then that it's not hopeless.
It's absolutely not hopeless. And you know what? The five young women, incidentally, all the students visiting are women. I kind of love that. they're going to be the ones that help us solve this.
While we're collecting questions from our members and guests, let me ask the first question. The oceans don't belong just to the United States. They belong to the world. And it doesn't seem to me that we're going to be able to solve all the problems by ourselves. What do you see as the future of work to remedy the problems we have now? Is it going to be an era of competition or an area of cooperation? And are there any formal mechanisms, governmental or otherwise, that have been set up to help the international community work these problems?
Yeah, so there, cooperation is, in my view, always the way to go. So one area that would make an impact in a number of different ways that relating to the ocean is for the United States to sign the Law of the Sea. Right now, we are not a signatory of the Law of the Sea, and that really diminishes our ability to impact or even to be involved in some conversations involving things like deep sea mining, which is something that is getting a lot of attention today. This is the idea of going down and harvesting manganese nodules and other minerals from the bottom of the ocean. We should be a player in that. So if I had to say one thing, I would say the United States needs to sign the law of the sea and be a player at the table. The other thing, you know, there's a lot is said about the developing countries are now the real sources of a lot of the carbon. The United States generated a lot of the carbon that's out there now, but now we're not the major player in that. And yet, U.S. leadership, we need to start assuming the moral high ground a little bit by reducing our own carbon footprint aggressively, and then working in what... this is where it's on the radio, so how much can I say? So I would like to see the United States aggressively go after carbon reduction strategies so that we have the moral authority to be a leader in this whole process moving forward, because we are a country with the resources that a lot of other countries don't have that can make an impact. I think I'm going to leave it with that. Wow.
Yeah, I know.
It's like taking a qualifying exam.
We always
have
a lot of questions. Do you think we should push our political leadership to create an independent body to make policy decisions about climate change? Is it too political now?
Do I think we should make a separate... You know, we've got the... No. We've got the structures in place within a number of the agencies to be able to do that. So I don't think we need a whole new body. What I would love to see is, for example, in ocean science. I'm on the board of the Consortium of Ocean Leadership, which right now, like many science organizations, we're struggling to stay, you know, viable and financially viable. And yet, where in the United States is there a group trying to pull together industry, academia, and the federal labs to set national priorities? Where is that happening? I'll tell you, it's not. So we need to invest in organizations and bodies. They already exist. We just need to empower them to talk to each other. How can we leverage resources? Who's doing what? How do we reduce duplication? And really, how do we set priorities? And the starting point in that cannot be political. It's got to be scientific, which means you're going to have to get the scientists involved because they know the status of the science. I don't think we don't need new organizations. We need to empower the ones that are already out there.
Well, then could you comment on the value of citizen scientists in this process? Are there things that individuals can do to help this?
Yes.
Scientifically?
Yes. God, that's a great question. So I said monitoring is so important. It's also incredibly expensive. We will never have the scientific workforce that we need to measure all the things in the environment that we need to. But empowering citizen scientists, so for example, there's a group in Booth Bay, and it's actually this whole region. Robert Jordan, I'm going to call out Robert. I have to make sure he listens to this on the radio. Is one of the gentlemen in the community where I live that is helping to coordinate citizen science to collect temperature, salinity, nutrient data all up and down the coast. Bigelow, this big data discovery center that I told you about that we're developing through this new strategic plan, part of that center is to try to capture data from citizen science. We have a researcher, Nick Record, who is who's got a background in oceanography, marine learning, and artificial intelligence. What he is trying to do is develop marine forecasts. And he's doing it right now. He does tick forecasts and he does jellyfish forecasts. And the way he's doing it is if you've got a phone and you see a jellyfish, take a picture. It will, with that picture, if you've taken it and your phone is a GPS, if you upload that, he knows where it was. This is a way to collect all this information without costing us anything, feeding it into a data stream, and now as the more data he collects, the better his forecast. He also does it for ticks, which isn't ocean science, but it's cool. So properly managed citizen science programs are incredibly valuable, and the most important part of that, I would argue, is that the people that are involved with Robert Jordan that are collecting all these water samples, they are paying attention to the environment, they are paying attention to the issues, they are educating themselves as they're doing this data collection. And that's what we need. We need an informed citizenship. So yes, yes, yes to citizen science.
Thank you. Here's a question on how our federal government is doing on this. How much does Bigelow, or do Bigelow and other laboratories rely on data collected by the federal government, and are they affected by reductions in data collection?
So that's kind of a hard question to ask, because who is the federal government? In the sense, 80% of our funding at Bigelow is our federal grants or philanthropic foundation grants. So Bigelow is the federal government in that case, right? It's university researchers that receive federal grants that are collecting that data. So we have access to that data because we're collecting it. I think maybe this question is coming from a couple of years ago when the new administration came in. There was data that was pulled offline. A lot of climate data was pulled offline. My understanding is most of that has been back, and there is a lot of discussion through the Council of Scientific Society presidents on how to back up and protect that. But it hasn't impacted science, the kind of science that we do. But really, in terms of what is federal data, we are the federal data producers, and right now we have not had problem accessing data. One of the problems we do have, and again, I don't mean to plug this big data center, but one of the challenges, there's so many different types of data out there, and they're all different. What we are not good at all, is how do we pull all of those various data streams into usable stories or data products? You know, so we've got satellite data. We've got data that's being collected off of a pier. We've got wind data. We've got citizen science data. What we need from a computer science standpoint, a machine learning standpoint, is how do we integrate all of those data streams into things that people can actually use?
Thank you. I'm skipping around a little bit here, but the questions are all over the place, and it's a little difficult to organize them all at once. People are worried about the timelines of the decline of the lobsters, lobster fisheries and other fisheries. Are we talking about things that are going to happen quickly, or do we have time to react to them?
Oh God. I don't think. First of all, I'm not an expert on the lobster fishery, so I would hesitate to say anything about the lobster industry. The other thing that makes this a really hard question to answer is, to be able to answer it, we have to assume that things are happening linearly, and they're not, right? So we get to a point, you've all heard about tipping points. We think we have time. One thing I can say is that predictions from 10, 15 years ago that said we would be in a certain state right now, they happened in 5 years, not 10 or 15. Things seem to be speeding up in general. I'm also going to use this highlight one thing that scientists in general really struggle with, is putting their neck out and saying something. So the colleagues, the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, the National Climate Assessment Report that I mentioned, Andy Pershing was one of the scientists that lead scientists for one of those chapters. So Gulf of Maine Research Institute put their neck out and started making some predictions. This is what we need science to do. Well, all the predictions weren't right, and they got hammered for it. So as a community, this again goes into an informed citizen. If you want scientists to try to give their best guesses, sometimes we're going to be wrong. And so then to beat up and attack the scientists for that is just going to shut down the conversation that scientists are going to be willing to do. So do I think it's going to happen in the next 3 years? Probably not. Would I bet on it in the next 5 years? That's getting a little scary. On the other hand, there's some wacky ideas that I think we could be doing with lobsters. In Chesapeake Bay, we are continually putting out oyster spat in Chesapeake Bay because the oyster industry basically collapsed in Chesapeake Bay. Could we be doing things like that with lobsters? Could we continually raise baby lobsters through that point where they're vulnerable to acidification and warming and continually spread them out? Would they stay in waters before they get up to Canada so that we could harvest them? I mean, I think there's all kinds of out-of-the-box kind of ways we can think about going after and saving that industry that we should be considering.
Thank you. There's quite a few questions here about your comments on kelp, including whether there's a way to grow kelp or its equivalent in deeper water, the impacts of the harvesting of kelp now, and whether what the time frame might be for developing these single-cell organisms that could reduce the methane emission from cattle and other animals.
So we've got the organisms right now. We are entering into trials with real cows. Bigelow doesn't have any cows. So we are partnering with Wolf Neck Farms, University of New Hampshire, an economist at Colby. One of my goals for Bigelow is really to try to bring as many different groups together, kind of on a small state scale of what I think we need to be doing at the national level. So we've got the organisms now. In terms of growing kelp in deep water, yeah, we can grow kelp in deep water. Kelp is a relatively low, coastal farms are relatively low tech, and so they're pretty easy to set up. We do need to be careful in the state that we have some kind of coordination so that we don't flood the entire coastal zone of Maine with kelp farms. Offshore farms can be challenging because the farther out, anybody that has ever been out in the ocean, it's a scary place. Things happen. But you can definitely grow kelp offshore. You can grow kelp anywhere where there's a turbulent environment where that is delivering nutrients from the deep ocean. That's where you need to grow kelp. So yes, you can grow it out in the open ocean.
How about the impact of harvest on kelp? Harvest of kelp now.
So the impact of harvest of kelp, I don't know so much about kelp. I know that the rockweed industry right now in Maine was a very well-managed industry. So if you live on the coast and you've seen these boats that go down and they almost are like vacuuming up the shore, they are harvesting rockweed, which I think it's 18 inches. They have to leave 18 inches behind, which is the most stringent requirement out there of any state or in Canada. And so it was a sustainable fishery, or I guess it's not a fishery. It was a sustainable business. One of the things that's changed in Maine, though, is they have modified who owns that kelp or that rockweed, where now it is part of the landowner instead of the public good. And that is really messing with the industry and a very bad idea in my mind. But in terms of harvesting kelp, there are lots of farms out there growing. I don't know of widespread industrial harvesting of wild kelp. Sorry, okay. I don't. Yeah. No.
Thank you. Here, a more general question. Other than sea level rise, what are the primary impacts of glacier and ice sheet melting on the ocean's ecosystem? I think you mentioned some in your talk, but could you reiterate that for us, please?
So one impact is it seems to be changing nutrient and micronutrient levels. So, for example, as the parts of the ocean are limited, let me take a step back. Out in the ocean, in any given place, the growth of phytoplankton is going to be limited by something. Maybe it's sunlight, maybe it's temperature. Oftentimes, it's nitrogen. They have everything they need to grow and make more cells, but nitrogen. In other parts of the ocean, it's iron. What we are seeing coming off of glaciers and ice sheets is as they melt, they are releasing a fair bit of iron. So as these ice sheets that have existed for thousands of years are moving into the ocean, they're not just bringing water, they're bringing all kinds of other things. Most of those things are natural, right, because there was no pollutants 10,000 years ago when some of these sheets were forming. But they are having an impact, some good ways. Iron is a good thing in some parts of the ocean. But so they are delivering a number of different materials into the ocean.
And I want to address two different issues that have been raised by a number of people. One, you might know that there's been a fish on land aquaculture proposed in Belfast. And there are a lot of people worried about the impact of those types of facilities on the water, the discharges, et cetera. And there's a huge number of questions. But could you address the impact of these type of facilities?
So as a nitrogen researcher, the best element in the world, when I first heard about land-based aquaculture, that was my first thought, is how are they going to manage the nutrients? Because if they don't properly manage the nutrients, the degradation of the rivers will be extreme. The mass of fish that they are talking about raising could really cause a lot of problems. Now, I have seen, so there are two different land-based salmon companies going in, and I'm trying to remember which one I reviewed their nutrient plans. They're basically building a wastewater treatment just for their business entity. What I saw, it looked like they were managing it well, or the plan was to manage it well. And I can't really say much more than that. But I think it is a really interesting concept, and I would love for them to be successful, because what they are doing, like I said, if you put something in the ocean, it's kind of a crapshoot of whether you're getting it back. And I've been on a lot of research cruises all around the world where we invested heavily in some piece of instrumentation and it came back mangled, or it didn't come back at all. So if we can learn to do some of these things on land and do them well, and there are ways we can do them well, removing nitrogen isn't rocket science, unfortunately, even though my parents felt it was. If they manage this well, this is a great thing, right? The towns that we could be bringing back through these kinds of industries desperately need employment. They need good jobs. They need sustainable jobs. So is it a danger? Absolutely. Do we need to pay very close attention that they do it correctly? Yes. Do I think it's a good thing? Yes.
And finally, the most political question of all, I believe, is what can we do to convince those doubters in the White House that the problem is real?
So we had a couple of great talks. We talk a lot about science communication at the Council of Scientific Society Presidents. And there's a researcher at Yale University, Kahan, who did a study looking at providing information about climate change to people that self-identify as liberals and people that self-identify as conservatives. And the more information you gave to people that self-identified as liberals, the more concerned they were about the problem. The more you gave to conservatives, the less concerned they were about the problem. Now, I come from a very conservative family. And both of my parents are gone, but they were incredible people. I argued with them constantly about various things, but they loved this country. But they had very different concerns. My dad grew up in the Depression. Money and putting food on the table was paramount. So I think when we talk to people, one, respect them, respect where they're coming from, right? They're not bad people just because they don't agree with you. My dad was one of the smartest human beings I've ever met, and I have spent years in academia. And I would watch my very liberal friends come in and say, let me talk to Frank. Good, I'm going to watch this. Okay, so some of it, I think, one, maybe you're not going to change their mind. You're just not. But the way we often talk to people that are climate deniers, we are setting up a confrontation instead of a conversation, and we need to have a conversation.
Thank you very much.